What is a genre-busting musician? We're going to meet one in this episode of The Spirit of Leading. Hi, I'm Garland McWaters, your host for The Spirit of Leading. And on this episode, we have Patrick Conlon, a sought-after composer and performer of contemporary music living right here in Oklahoma City. Patrick, thanks for taking time to tell us a little bit about yourself and about your music.
Thanks for having me.
I might tell our audience that one reason why we wanted to include you in this podcast this week is because you were just recently recognized as one of the Next Gen Under 30 honorees in Oklahoma by the Next Gen Leadership Oklahoma organization at their annual banquet. And you joined others from around the state who are examples in their profession and in their community service to what Oklahoma can be like and what kind of leadership our young people are already offering to the state. And so it's real exciting to have you here today to talk to you about not only your music, but also, you know, your life in Oklahoma. And I might also say that you received actually the first of the inaugural Mark Costello Spirit Award, which was an award we started presenting this year that honors the late labor commissioner Mark Costello here in Oklahoma, and because of his love for the state and the spirit that he brought to the state in his leadership, we thought it really was appropriate to honor him in that way. And so congratulations on receiving that award.
Thank you so much.
You know, you have a number of professional assignments. You're the assistant director of the Academy of Contemporary Music here at the University of Central Oklahoma in their Bricktown facility. And also, you're a violinist, composer, in residence at the Los Angeles New Music Ensemble. And that, and I know there's other things going on in your life professionally. It sounds like you're a pretty busy fella.
I am. There is no day that you can't stuff some work into, I guess.
What are your main responsibilities here at the Academy of Contemporary Music?
Sure. So as assistant director, I'm mostly in charge of the academic side of things here. And so we look at curriculum. I work with my program directors to make sure that, you know, as the music industry changes, we're covering everything that we should in our classes. As we grow as a program, that we're making sure they're getting everything they need from their education.
Okay. That's kind of the administrative side mm-hmm. of the work. And I know there's more of a creative side to your work as well. You compose and you perform and things of that nature. When did you decide you wanted to be a composer, and how did you develop that line of skills?
For me, it's something I've just always done. I started playing violin when I was 7, and before that, I would play around on the piano and write things. And I started doing MIDI composition as soon as we had a 386 computer that you could do that on. And basically, just from the beginning, I always wrote my own music. If I was supposed to be practicing, I realized that if you improvised and made up your own stuff, it sounded like you were practicing, even though you were having fun. And so that was kind of how it started. I was in rock bands all throughout high school. We had a few little bands that we'd play basement shows. And at the same time, I was in orchestras and working with the kind of classical side of it as well. And for me, there's never really been a barrier between the two. I've always done both. Mm-hmm. For me, it's very much I'm a musician who happens to play violin rather than someone who's defined by their instrument.
Well, I think that's the difference between a musician and someone who just plays an instrument. Mm-hmm. I grew up playing an instrument, but mm-hmm. I never really learned to be a musician. But I enjoyed playing my instrument. I played, you know, the saxophone and played in bands like you and others. And I've always been absolutely amazed at people who can take something in their head and turn it into something that everyone can enjoy, you know, such as music or write a song. That must be very gratifying to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that I've always done.
So was that an atmosphere in your home that really encouraged that kind of exploration musically?
Yeah, definitely. My parents always really encouraged being creative and working that way. And so my mom is a classical flutist and my dad played guitar. My grandmother was actually the first female music critic for the newspapers up there, for the Ottawa Citizen.
And so, well, you mentioned Ottawa. Now, I understand you were a native Canadian mm-hmm. born and then migrated to Oklahoma.
Yeah, I moved down here when I was, I think, 12. And I got the naturalized dual citizenship about 3 years ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so now University of Oklahoma, I think, is where you mm-hmm. where you studied.
Yeah, so I ended up they kept giving me great deals, and I loved all my teachers. So I ended up doing 4 degrees there, 2 for a double major for my bachelor's, and then 2 master's degrees after that.
Well, I'm interested in this idea of contemporary music. Mm-hmm. I described you in my introduction as genre busting. And so how does that fit in? How do you bust a genre?
So for me, I think it's that whatever your normal is. And so for me growing up, listening and playing classical music and rock and pop was my normal. And so I think anytime you get a new generation, you get a new normal for that generation. And there's a lot of me's out in especially places like LA and New York now, who grew up doing both. It wasn't a one or the other. Whereas a lot of times for my parents' generation, if you were a classical musician, that was your focus. And I think now it's become, for me, that was just my normal to do both. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same way some people will be across genre and do country and rock or jazz and classical. For me, I was always interested in all of it, and I always got the chance to experience all of it. So for me, that was my normal.
Well, is there kind of a sound in your head that you kind of... that drives you in terms of the kind of music that you compose?
Yeah, I definitely am. So I had a professor way back when tell me, there's music that says, love me, I love you, and music that sits in the corner and waits for you to come talk to them. And I am definitely a love me, I love you in my music. But for me, I think for any art, but especially for me doing music, I like there to be something for everyone at every level of the music. So if you don't know anything about music, you can listen to it and just kind of feel it and like how it moves and the gesture works and the timing works and kind of those big gestures, those big structural things. But if you want to zoom in and look at the actual nitty-gritty of the theory and the motivic development or the harmony or what's happening kind of on a molecular level, that's there as well. And so for me, really great art gets you on all of those levels.
I was listening to your music before as I was preparing for this podcast, and I was taken by how melodious some of it is. Very kind of like it wants to grab you by the shoulders and shake you a little bit. Mm-hmm. Has a little bit of everything.
Yeah, for me, so accessibility has kind of a dirty word in quote-unquote high art, right? You know, it's like if it's easy to understand, it must be simple. And so for me, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think there's some art forms that in order to do what you're doing, it has to be thorny and difficult. But there's other... For me, it's really having something at every level.
Right.
So making sure that at that kind of first blush, the piece does grab you so that then you'll want to kind of explore it more and keep going for it.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. I've heard riders talk about their work kind of in that way, and some are very flowery and involved in the way they ride, and others are like Hemingway, right to the point. You know, I mean, as few words as possible and only what's necessary. And so different styles evoke a kind of a different kind of experience. I think that the thing that sort of drew me to your work was this idea of this contemporary sound. That it sort of is it says something of everything. And you know, as you think forward in the kind of music you want to do down the road, are you exploring some new angles of that, some new sound, some new combinations that you'll be showing to us down the road?
Yeah, absolutely. So my big thing, and I tell all my students this, and the worst thing is trying to take your own advice, especially as an artist. But the advice I always give them is just write. Like, there's no your sound unless there's product, and you don't know what's going to come out, and whatever you write is going to sound like you because it's you writing it. And so one of the things the last couple of years for me that's been really important has been getting out of the head of what will people think of this, how will they think about it, and just diving into the piece. Right now I have a few works on the table. I'm writing a piece for the Fort Smith Symphony called Wub Wub Wub. And so it's a kids' concert, so I wanted to do something that'd be fun and flashy for the kids. So I'm doing a dubstep concerto. So it's going to be a clarinet concerto that's doing all those kind of wop 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 wop, all those kind of bro step things that people hear about. But it's also very much a classical concerto, and it has all of those trappings of a concerto, and a lot of the moves that you have in EDM or electronic dance music are the same moves you would do in a concerto. So that's the kind of idea of that genre busting. And for me, it's that both sides have to be just as good. So if you're going to do a successful cross-genre piece, it can't just be a good dubstep piece and a terrible orchestra piece, or a great orchestra piece, but a really kind of flabby, not there dubstep piece. It has to have both. And so that's the hard part of doing them. But I think that's also kind of the fun part. So if you're a 8-year-old at this concert, there's going to be flashy, cool things happening. It sounds kind of like dubstep music that you've heard before. So they have all of those things for them. But for the musicians who want to die in, there's kind of some, not so much jokes, but just homages to earlier pieces and structural things that are based off of previous pieces as well.
I'm sure it'll be fascinating. So now, are you performing any place at this time, or do you perform regularly?
Yeah, so I'm the principal second violin with the Fort Smith Symphony. I also play with Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, Tulsa, Lawton, and I sub with the OKC Phil occasionally.
Like I said, you're a man on the go. You're a busy guy.
I have put a lot of miles on my car on the weekends. Yeah. We call ourselves weekend warriors.
I might tell everyone that we're recording this this podcast actually in the studio offices, you know, of the UCO's Academy for Contemporary Music in Oklahoma City, down the Bricktown area. So you mentioned something earlier about playing or writing for yourself. And I think this is always a question that, that an artist gets is, well, what about listening to the critic's voice? How do you not listen to the critic's voice? And particularly when you do want your work to be accepted by people, not let the critic bother you or discourage you. Do you have to kind of tune yourself to that, or just getting hard skinned, or what?
Yeah, so I think you throw a lot of temper tantrums and eventually stop throwing temper tantrums. The big thing for me was once I'd finally written enough that it felt like every piece wasn't kind of, I needed to hang on to it because it was me as an artist and it had to be exactly the way I wanted it, because I'll write another piece, it'll just get the piece done. And it's not a kind of selling out idea, as a, you have to kind of separate yourself from the work at some point. And so one thing, this is kind of the hardest thing of being an artist, is that when you're doing the beginning of the creative process, you need to be a total cheerleader for yourself. So you can do it. This is great. This is fantastic. You need to follow this. I call it fishing sometimes. So it's, you're trying to find the right thing. And then when you find, you kind of get a bite creatively. You want to follow that path. You don't want to think about it too much. You don't want to just let your intuition go as far as your intuition will go. And then activate the other part of the brain and say, all right, what's actually working with this? So you kind of have to be both editor or producer and artist. And it really becomes, for me, the big thing was letting go of the piece as being representational of me once I have to edit it. So then it's not, I spent 10 hours writing that, I can't cut that out of the piece. It becomes, the piece needs that to be cut.
Do you bring others into the process along the way to say, well, what do you think about this? Or what do you hear? What are you hearing what I think I'm writing or producing?
Mm-hmm. I'm really lucky in that my partner, Christina Giacona, is very similarly musically oriented. She's a clarinetist with Fort Smith Symphony as well. She's a producer. And so I kind of have an in-house, if I hit that roadblock, I call her and she tells me all the things I have to fix, and then I'll keep going.
Well, it's good to have someone like that to be that partner for you. And I'm sure that there are always, well, writers talk about their muse. They talk about the people that are sort of always on their shoulder, whispering in their ear, you know, about this or that, and to kind of keep them on the right kind of path. I wanted to ask a little bit about some of the lessons you've learned about yourself along the way. I know we were kind of talking before the podcast about all the lessons we learned by the time we're in our mid-20s, which is kind of close to where you are. I'm sure there have been some things that have really impacted you, that have helped you discover who you are individually, not only as an artist, but also as a person. Mm-hmm. But what have you learned about yourself through this journey so far?
Yeah, so one of the big things for me has been not beating yourself up for being yourself. Not that I'm a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. Whatever my brain chemistry is, I get over things quickly, which is a good thing as an artist. For me, it was always all of my professors wanted me to do that thing, whatever their thing was. So my violin professor wanted me to practice more. My composition professor wanted me to practice less and compose more. My math teacher in high school wanted me to be a mathematician. You know, everybody sees if you have potential in something and wants you to be that thing. And for me, kind of realizing that it's not that I would do better if I would just focus on one thing, but that for me, this kind of being multi-directional is what for me actually makes me special and makes me the way that I am.
Do you think that shows up in the way you compose or your music itself?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, it's, and I think everything shows up if you're composing enough. So it's sort of like statistics, right? If you look at an individual piece by someone, you might not necessarily get what they're about. But if you get 10 or 20 pieces and start looking at kind of the overall arc of their work, you start to see, you know, like, oh, this is what they're doing. This is what they're exploring. This is what's changing.
You find yourself kind of changing the direction of your interests as you go, as you kind of learn from one composition to the next.
Yeah, absolutely. For example, Christina and I have been producing a band here in town called Electric Airways, and it's pure pop. I mean, it is absolutely radio-ready pop. That's the sound, which is very different from the stuff that I work on myself. But with that, what you need to do is create this sense of kind of fullness and perfection, but it sounds very simple. But it sounds simple, even though there's six guitar parts and three piano parts and a string section. But it's all kind of done so you don't hear any of those individual parts. You just think, oh, it sounds full. And so orchestrationally, if you're writing an orchestra piece, you can do very similar things with pairing instruments together and making these sounds that are not necessarily complex pitch-wise, but are complex kind of texture-wise and things like that.
Yeah, that's that sound design idea, I guess, I'm hearing you talk about there.
Yeah, and then for me also, I get a lot of inspiration from other art forms. So I do a lot of writing and I do a lot of reading of poetry and other books. Like I'm reading Gödel Escher Bach right now. which is kind of this rumination on artificial intelligence, and but he does it by talking about Bach fugues versus, you know, mathematical formulas versus Escher paintings, of these sort of strange feedback loops that are happening in all these things. And so that, for me, that's the kind of thing that you read that and you go, like, that is absolutely applicable. Like, the piece you were listening to was based off of a poem called Mirror Sermon. That was about Dennis Brutus, who's a South African poet. It was his relationship with South Africa, which was pretty fraught for him. What I took from it was sort of, it had seven stanzas, and it had these musical, there's mention of a gavotte, and there's a gavotte in the piece, and a sarabande, and things like that. But I didn't worry too much about text setting it correctly, but the piece is in seven parts, and each one's sort of goes with the stanza, and basically I'm stealing his poetic structure and putting it in the piece. And it's in such a way that no one would ever know if I didn't tell them. I mean, there's no...
Right.
No one could ever go there and figure that out.
Right.
But for me, it just gave it, like, a seven-section piece is kind of interesting, because mm-hmm. it's not a four-section piece or a three-section piece. And it just gave me kind of this rough direction that I could kind of jump off of.
And that's really what you described as really a creative process that I think I've heard over and over, that people just doesn't come out of thin air.
Right.
It doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from, I heard this, or I saw that, or someone told me this, and I kind of thought, well, those kind of go together in a funny, kind of interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
And you recombine them and come up with something that's sort of a part of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what creativity is. And I've worked with people who say, well, I'm not very creative. They think it's got to be totally, like, out of nowhere.
But right, and I think that's, like, the great lie of art.
Yes.
So it's like Mozart, for example, is the premium example of the boy genius who just notes came out of thin air and everything. And that's actually total lies that were written by his biographer after he died to sell copies of the biography. And so there's letters from him where he's going, I don't have a piano, I don't know how to figure this part out, like, can I come borrow your piano so I can figure this part out for the section? There's spots where he gets completely creatively stuck. Schubert's Unfinished Symphony is an example of that. We always think of it as this, like, he died tragically in the middle of the symphony, because that's how all unfinished symphonies happen, right? Yeah. No, he worked on it for 10 years and couldn't figure out how to modulate out of the key, and so he just kept shelving it and then trying to come back to it. So yeah, I think it's, the creative process involves work. You have to spend the time doing whatever you're doing. And then there's a lot of kind of background processing. So I think it's like you work yourself up to that wall, and then you keep thinking about it. So, like, walks or showers or times when your body has to be doing something that's not terribly interesting, your brain just sort of works on those problems in the background.
And then eureka. Well, that kind of brings me to the last question I wanted to ask. What have you... What kind of advice do you give to young aspiring, whether they might be artists or entrepreneurs or just young people who are looking to find their way in their professional lives? Something you learned that you thought, boy, I'm glad that happened, or maybe something somebody told you that really made a difference in you at a particular time.
For me, a lot of it is just to do it. I get students occasionally who they say, how can I make money at this? And it's like, that's not how art works. And it's kind of a really sad thing about, you know, the way our economic capitalist system works, that it tries to impose those tendencies on it. And those things are important for trying to make, you know, a living as an artist. You know, knowing, okay, what are the income streams available to me, all of those things. That's very important. That's a big thing of what we do here. But for the actual art side, it's you just need to make art. And you need to do it until you're good enough that people are willing to pay you for it. Really, what is music school but playing in an orchestra for free, right? Mm-hmm. It's basically you're paying to go to a school to get the experience to do it so that when you're ready to get paid to do it, you have time. And that works with music school because we'll spend all semester working on a piece, whereas when you're in the real world, you get 3 days, right? It's that kind of idea of you can't do anything to make people like or dislike your work, but you can just continually work at it and iterate and get better. And that kind of idea of iteration, for me, a lot of it's about kind of speed. So it's once you get comfortable enough with a certain process, then you can tackle these harder processes. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm stuck at a point in the piece and I've already done things a certain way, how do I go on from there? And I think a lot of times for, especially people in their early 20s, late teens, really undergrad is the point where this happens with a lot of people, undergrad and grad school, is they hit the wall where they've composed all the pieces that happen naturally to them. I call this kind of the second album mm-hmm. conundrum. It's that as a band, you've been together for 10 years, because most bands that make it have been together for quite a while. So they've been together 5 or 10 years, and then they do an album of all the best songs that they've written over the last 10 years. And then they've got a year and a half to write the second album, and it's really hard.
It's really hard, yeah.
And so for me, it's that it shouldn't get any easier. You could get faster at doing things that you know how to do. And for me, there's certain things like I can ape Philip Glass, no problem, because I was obsessed with him enough in high school. I kind of figured out how to write like Philip Glass did in the 80s. I couldn't do what he does tomorrow, though. And right. So the idea is that like it should be uncomfortable and hard. And sometimes I think that's the reason I went into music and art in general, is it's the hardest thing that I did, because there's no right answer. There's just kind of expression and communication and something else to be interested in once you've figured out that last question.
Right. And that's really good advice, I guess, that we can offer, is that sometimes we want it too easy. If it doesn't come easily, then we kind of lose interest, or we think we're a failure, or we do something really well, and then the next thing that comes along is hard and it's not that well, so we give up and quit. Mm-hmm. It's pushing through that that is the difference maker.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's that idea of practice, but practice to always improve. Mm-hmm. And I still practice violin, and I play really slow scales and very simple keys. I mean, it's you're doing the same thing you did when you were six.
Right.
And you're just listening to it, and you're doing that same kind of process of self-improvement. And I think that's really the difference, is anyone who you see that's made it, they've been daily improving themselves for years or decades. And that's what it takes.
Well, fascinating. And I wish we had a lot more time to talk about your work and experience. Perhaps we can pick it up somewhere down the road. But I do want to explore what's happening here at the Academy itself. Tell us a little bit about what the Academy does and kind of why it is a very big asset to Oklahoma City at this time.
Sure. So what we focus on, we've got about 350 to 400 students right now, which is very large for a music school. And we're a separate department from the School of Music at the University of Central Oklahoma. We're great friends. We pass students back all the time. But what we focus on is the contemporary music industry and all the things that are related to that. So contemporary performance, which could be hip-hop, EDM, pop, country, R&B, all of those genres that wouldn't be covered under either classical or jazz studies. We do audio engineering, so the music production side, so the engineering, the actual recording, the mixing, the mastering, but also the post-production, so doing music and sound for film, doing Foley work and live sound. And then the music business side, which is kind of the thing that no one in the music business industry got degrees in music business.
Right.
They were all lawyers or people who worked in a record store who got to know the band. It was all kind of learn on the fly. And one of the things we're trying to do is take those kind of what for a contemporary music industry, it's really been on an apprentice model for the last 100 years. And take that kind of apprentice model and make a structural program out of it, so that our thing is kind of to bring you behind the curtain and say, this is how it's actually work. You know, if you want to know how this Britney Spears single happened, these were all the steps. These are the people who worked on it. These people did this. These people did that. So it can become a reality. And also so they can know what the lifestyle would be working that. That's a big thing I do with my students is, so I teach a film scoring class. And the first thing I always ask them is, do you like really short deadlines? Because as the musician, you're always the last person there, because it needs to be picture locked before you can do the final cuts right. of the music. And even before that, you know, they're making a lot of changes in the editing room before it even gets to you. So you're the last person. They're always over budget. They're, you know, 3 weeks behind schedule. So even major motion pictures usually only have about 6 weeks for the composer to kind of put the whole thing together. And it's also a very client-based relationship. So when you're writing your own music, you're kind of the boss of how it's going to end up. If you're writing music for someone's movie, you're dressing their baby, you know, and they probably have something in their mind for how it was supposed to sound. And no matter what you do, it's probably not exactly your first draft. And so getting it so they actually know what that relationship feels like. This is what it act. This process is this. So I know I talk a lot about process versus product. And it's sort of like the process is what you actually spend time doing.
Right.
So that's the thing you need to fall in love with.
It takes a lot of time to get something done in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. The magic of this place is that, so all the students are here and all the graduates, we still work with all of our alumni, but even with all the instructors, so that kind of collective knowledge that you get as part of a group of people who are like-minded and have the same goals, that's something that's how you get a music scene. I mean, if you have enough people, enough collective knowledge that it's easy to learn those things, easy to access, then that's how you kind of get that idea. And having that makes other artists want to come here and stay as well.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Oklahoma City might be the next big music place where things are happening. It certainly looks like we're on our way to that. Well, listen, Patrick, thanks so much for taking time to visit with me about your work and experience. And again, let me congratulate you on being recognized as one of Oklahoma's outstanding young people and under the age of 30. And let me just say that as I've traveled about the state, done other interviews similar to this, it's just so impressive to see so many young people doing so many just amazing things, either professionally or in community work, community service. It's very heartening, and I keep telling people I'm not worried about the future. I think we have so much talent out there available that if we can just find ways to let that talent just come to the surface and work, that great things are in store for our communities and our state and our country. So it's wonderful to talk to you, and congratulations on your recognitions, and best of luck to what the contributions you're making here with the school and your own profession.
Thank you so much.
That's Patrick Conlon. He's an Oklahoma City composer and musician, and he's the assistant director of the Academy of Contemporary Music at the University of Central Oklahoma, which is located in Bricktown, the Bricktown District of Oklahoma City. He's also the violinist and composer in residence of the Los Angeles New Music Ensemble, plus many other things. And he was recently recognized as one of the 2016 honorees of the Next Gen Under 30 Leadership Class in Oklahoma by the Next Gen Leadership Oklahoma organization. And he's also a recipient of the new Mark Costello Spirit Award. A lot to say about him. Well, that's it for this episode of The Spirit of Leading, and thanks again for listening. I encourage you to recognize and appreciate any and everyone you know who demonstrates the spirit of leading at work or in the community. And I invite you to be watching for our next installment of The Spirit of Leading. Until then, I urge you to encourage the spirit, to enliven the heart, to enlighten the mind, and to enlarge the expectations of living in yourself and in others. Live each and every day empowered. I'm Garland McWaters. Thank you.